Welcome to the Spirit Lake Wellness Podcast with Dr. John Ewing and Kathy Kocher. This is the first of a three-part series on finding meaning in life. Today, our panelists discuss the impact of trauma on that journey.
So, what I was interested in doing today was exploring what do we mean by the meaning of things? What is meaning? And so, mien is an old French word which means the middle of things. And mens is where we get the idea of mental and memory to join things together. So in an intellectual sense, meaning then is how do we join things together in our mind? But I think when people talk about meaning, they're talking about feelings. Any thoughts on that, Kathy?
Well, I think I agree. I think meaning for me is about perception, how we perceive things, how we interpret things, how we create the meaning of something, and they can be really unique to each person, phenomenology. It's, you know, what we think is real becomes real. And so the meaning of things becomes a really important tool. I was thinking about this before the call, you know, what are my thoughts on meaning? And the big thing for me is when I was doing trauma work, if you could change the meaning of the traumatic event, you could leapfrog into healing. And it was a really important part of recovery for people to shift the meaning of what happened to them.
Okay, so could you elaborate on that a little bit and tell me, you know, I guess they have a memory of a series of events.
Mm-hmm.
And then what do you mean by meaning and how does it change? What does it change to?
Well, this is the part that this has always fascinated me, John. Most of my trauma work was with children and young people. And most of the trauma occurred as children, abuse or neglect primarily. And so most of those people kind of locked those memories in at the age they were when it happened. And for the sake of argument, let's say the person was six. So that whole traumatic event or series of events is locked in with the perception and emotion and understanding of the six-year-old. So now when you revisit it at 16 or 26, you take it out and you look at it and you can shift the meaning of what happened because you're no longer six. You know, you're not looking at it through the eyes of a six-year-old. You have more life experience. You can look at that and go, wow, I wasn't a bad person. This was, you know, my parents' mental health issue or this stranger's dysfunction that caused this to happen. And it wasn't something I did wrong. And you can shift that perspective of what happened to them. And you can just see them lighten going, oh, I wasn't a bad person. You know, because you can shift that meaning, that perception, that view. You can bring it into the light and look at it with a different set of tools and a different level of experience. And then the meaning of what happened shifts. I'm being kind of repetitive, and I'm sorry, but I just think
it's so powerful. Meaning is one of those things that it implies a context, a connection with other things. Mm-hmm. And when we think about trauma, oftentimes there's a connection to feelings. So a series of events happen, and then we have a feeling. And this type of learning does not require our conscious intervention to remember things in a particular way. So very often events can trigger a set of perceptions, and sometimes the cues in our environment might trigger internal tension because we think we're about to encounter something really bad. And I think that's the basic nature of trauma is that we interpret cues in our environment in a way that causes intense internal tension. And then can also, along with this tension, and it may not be the event itself, but it could be the result of the tension that gives rise to all sorts of thoughts about, oh my gosh, this is scary. What kind of scary things are here? What might be happening? I'll bet that person's about to hit me. And so we can have this kind of direct bottom-up path to our emotions, which mm-hmm. also then elicits the thoughts that go along with that internal tension. So this is an interesting thing. When we look at the meaning of a traumatic event, so we have the cue, and then we have the internal tension. Sometimes we might have memories of the event or similar events, but then the tension itself leads to sensations, which triggers our thoughts and feelings. So can we ever really get at that learning that took place when a certain cue caused us to anticipate danger?
I believe we can. I mean, if we look at the example I use a lot is based on the Hebbian theory of personality development, where he...
Could you say that again? The what?
The gentleman's last name is Hebb, Dr. Hebb. And okay. It's the Hebbian theory of personality development. And the diagram that was used when I learned this was, the letter N. And your brain engram is the letter N. This happens, you have this thought, this perception, boom, it's the letter N. And it happens enough times that it's a pattern in your brain that you fall into, like you said, the event, the tension, the emotion, the response. Well, Hebb argued that with enough repetitions, you can change that N to an H. So you still maybe have that initial event, but you change your perception of it, you change the tension of it, you change the emotion and the action. But it takes a lot of repetition of the H to overcome the N, because the N has been there for a long time. And it also kind of explains, in my mind at least, kind of explains relapse. You're so used to doing the N that when you start trying to live doing an H, it's really easy to slip back to that N. It takes a long time of doing the H very consciously, very intentionally, for that to become the dominant pattern.
Right. So what I think I'm hearing you say, Kathy, is that because of past experiences, children often anticipate bad things or good things happening based on cues in their environment. And with repetition, it takes no conscious effort for that cue to trigger that internal tension.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what you're saying is that with that as we move from cue to tension, this internal gripping or tension is accompanied by thoughts, and that we can reinterpret our surroundings and our capabilities and modify that internal tension if we have the time to think about it and moderate that internal tension.
Right.
So when we're calm, we can do that.
Mm-hmm.
But when we get a sense of urgency or excitement, then the initial pattern emerges. And I think what you're saying is that if we repeat the new pattern that is not accompanied by such intense internal tension, that if we practice that enough, then that will become our knee-jerk response.
Yes, and it takes a lot of practice and a lot of repetition. I don't remember the study, but I remember hearing people talk anecdotally about mindfulness, and being mindful about things can help that process along. Just, you know, and some of the work in EMDR, which is a treatment that's frequently used with trauma with adults, is around creating a different mind space, so that when you talk about the trauma, you're creating a different pathway in some ways by modifying the visual path or a tactile path with tapping or things like that you're shifting how your brain processes, how it slips into that old track.
Yeah, that's interesting. When a therapist had learned EMDR and then went out on maternity leave, and when she came back, she wasn't sure about her EMDR skills, and so she wanted to practice. I just said, sure, why not? You know, I know how to sing Kumbaya, and I figured it was good. I was just kind of blown away at how intense the experience was of revisiting some of those early memories. The amount of emotion, it was overwhelming. And I can see why some people decompensate after EMDR.
Yeah.
The value, I think, was in becoming aware of those energies and then translating that into everyday life whenever I would run into a triggering cue to realize, oh, yeah, I'm triggered and flooded and, oh, okay, and now I'm in a different situation. And so I could reinterpret it in the now. Is that the basic gist of it? Or you were talking about something else, I think.
No, I think that's the gist of it, is that you get to a point in processing the trauma by creating a safe space to think about it or talk about it, however you choose to do it, that you can look and go, like you said, you change the meaning. I'm not in the same space. I don't have to have this reaction. It's not the same situation. You know, for some people, it wasn't me. I wasn't a bad person. It wasn't my fault. It was this other person's issue. Sometimes that is something that needs to become a mantra that they keep repeating. It wasn't me. I was born perfect.
Yeah.
You know.
Okay.
And you know how that works in other PTSD situations. I don't work with combat veterans. I don't have that experience. I can't speak to it. I can just speak with chronic, long-term trauma, as usually experienced by children and young adults.
Yeah. And then there's this tendency to interpret having experienced trauma as, oh, now I'm traumatized, and now I act out in a particular way if people aren't nice to me.
Yeah, you got to be careful with that. I mean, any time you give someone a label, you can create an opportunity to hang everything on that label. You know, I'm trying to think of one of the. Oh, I have a terminal cancer diagnosis. People should, you know, I should have deferred parking. I should have special privileges. You know, I was like, no. It just means you got to work a little harder to do stuff. You know, I have a diagnosis of depression. I shouldn't be expected to do these things or that things. It's like you have to be so careful with that. I remember going through the initial training in how to work with kids with trauma, and one of the comments was, "If everything is trauma, nothing's trauma." And it's like, oh yeah, we do have to be careful with that, because when ADD/ADHD was being diagnosed, everybody had it, but did they?
Yeah.
Because trauma and anxiety and attachment issues can also replicate that say, does that mean it's not a legitimate diagnosis? Good question. But the same thing with trauma. Yeah, you know, people have stuff in their, when you ask the person, was this traumatic? Do you have these symptoms from it? Sometimes they say no, but the significant other, the parent in their life goes, that's the trauma, because it was traumatic for them. It may not have been traumatic for the child. But if that child keeps hearing how traumatic it was, it will become a traumatic event for them.
Yeah. Yeah, one of the things I wonder about with soldiers is mm-hmm. that, you know, we are raised in a social structure. We have sort of conventions and rules, and we have an understanding of how things work. And we might watch movies about how things are supposed to work. And then some of these people get into extreme situations like combat, where those rules no longer apply.
Right.
And the rules become completely different in that situation. Yeah. And it's almost like being in a different culture. But then we put them on an airplane, fly them back home, send them back to their family on leave, and they're supposed to
switch,
reintegrate into that old model of the world. And all of a sudden it seems like, wait, this is plastic and hollow. This doesn't have any meaning.
Right.
I've even heard people say that it was when they were in combat that they felt alive. And goodness gracious. So yeah, I think part of that aspect of meaning then is interpreting the events around you. And then you've got, if you've had these sorts of combat experiences, then you have this one lens that, oh yes, when I was a child, I thought like this about all of these relationships and whatnot. And now I have this other filter too, this other way of looking at things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm remembering a conversation I had with someone who worked with combat vets, and it was at a conference, and we got chatting over coffee, and I said, how do you help, you know, these people when they come back, they've had these traumatic experiences, how do you help them reintegrate? And her comment was so shocking to me. She said, I can only take them so far because they still have to be a soldier. And then when they get discharged, then we look for people like you to take them the rest of the way in their healing. And it just really, I've thought about that so much since I heard that, about what we do when we train people to be soldiers, when we train them to have enough rigid routine and process that they can go into situations that most people would be terrified of, and go in with a sense of purpose, with a sense of meaning, with a sense of patriotism, whatever we want to call it. And they go in and they do and are subjected to things that are really horrific. And then they come back, and the military doesn't want to turn them back into a fully functioning person, because they may still need those soldier skills. So they help them to that point. And then where we drop the ball sometimes is when they get discharged, we don't always have people there to help them the rest of the way, so they can function in a family, so they can drive down the belt line and not freak out when they see a box on the side of the road, you know, thinking it's an IED. You know, it's just has struck me how we can really shift people's perception and meaning and sense of purpose to serve.
Yeah, I think that's a big part of what happened in Vietnam, is that the soldiers had been raised on all of this propaganda, these war movies and cowboy movies, good guy versus bad guy, and so then they had all this patriotism, and then they go over there, and then they figure out that, wait, the people that sent us here have no idea what's going on. we might actually be the bad guys. And this is a horrible situation.
Well, the other thing, interesting that you mentioned Vietnam, because I believe Vietnam was the first war conflict where soldiers did not return home with their units on ships. They were flown back one at a time or in small groups. So that whole informal debriefing process of being at sea for, 3 weeks, 6 weeks, however long it takes, didn't happen.
Yeah.
And I think there was a lot of healing and good, healthy stuff that happened in that process. And then how do you replicate it when you can't reassemble that platoon, stateside?
Yeah.
To do that process.
This is true. When they're going through training, people often develop close relationships with the people in their squad or in their team, and they can become very close and exchange a lot of ideas about the world and how it works. And then you get into a situation, and then that person gets killed, and it breaks your heart. And then your other friend gets killed, or they get wounded, and suddenly they're not there. And then there's this new guy that's likely to do something stupid and get you hurt. And then nobody wants to get to know the new guy. Nobody wants to connect with him because they know what's probably going to happen.
Yeah. And the power of the shared experience. You go through boot camp together. You go through training together. You go through your... the stuff you do to get prepared for the mission, I can't think of the word. You do all that together as a group. You're tight. You're like family, brothers at arms, all of that. And then you're in combat, and then you get sent home not as a group anymore. You're not a group anymore. Now you're individuals. Yeah. And it's not, I think we do a great disservice to the people that are really giving everything.
So talking about meaning then, a lot of times the soldiers will have some meaning for why they're going over there to do this particular mission or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then at some point they might ask questions and realize that, wait, this is a fantasy. This is not real. I don't know how they put this in the newspaper.
That soldier that set himself afire to protest what was happening in Palestine. That was interesting. Heartbreaking.
Yeah.
Heartbreaking. But interesting because that was not his mission.
Right.
But and then you know, at some point he looked and said, wait a minute, we're not the good guys here. This needs to change.
Yeah. And then when the political idealism evaporates on the battlefield, and then you have those friendships, those people in your team that you want to protect. And then when that disappears and when they're no longer there, then you're kind of all alone and nothing that you thought made sense.
Yeah.
And then you go back home on leave, and there you are sitting around the Christmas tree or whatever, and it seems fake. It seems like it doesn't matter.
Thank you for listening to the Spirit Lake Wellness Podcast. Spirit Lake Wellness is a 501c3 dedicated to health and wellness education. Learn more at spiritlakewellness.org.